From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Baltimore needs big investment in infrastructure, in roads, in sewers, and what about the city's internet infrastructure? We talk with a deputy mayor and a technology educator about Baltimore's digital future. Then, as Sandtown Winchester looks to its future, more than 30 neighborhood churches are helping to shape its path. Pastors of two of them, Amelia Harris of Newborn Community of Faith Church and Lewis Wilson of New Song Community Church, talk with Tom Hall about their plans in the wake of the riots. Plus, theater critic Jay Wynn Resick reviews Chesapeake Shakespeare Company's production of The Comedy of Errors. And poet Sue Ellen Thompson talks with Tom about the core of her latest work, a collection called They. She explores her relationships with her parents and with her transgender child. Now news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Baltimore has a lot of pressing infrastructure issues, leaky sewers, decaying bridges, lots of other transportation needs. And there's another important item to add to the list, digital infrastructure, the cables and wires that connect city residents to the internet. If you look at a map of super high-speed internet availability in central Maryland, you'll see Baltimore surrounded by opportunities to connect to the latest fiber optics networks. But in the city itself, it's a different story. There is no residential fiber optic service. A new draft report from a task force on moving the city forward into a digital future calls for expanded broadband access throughout the city. I spoke about it with the co-chair of that task force, Deputy Mayor Colin Tarbert. With Baltimore still recovering from the unrest in April, I asked him how technological investment fits into the city's long-term plan to reinvigorate itself.
Well, I think that broadband and technology is integral to all the different aspects of city government and moving our city forward. It really touches all aspects of city life, from transportation to workforce development to economic development. And so ensuring that we're maximizing our use of technology in the city, whether it's through, more efficient government services or literally using broadband to connect our residents to the internet, it's part and parcel of moving our city forward.
Well, I can imagine some people listening to us are saying, doesn't Baltimore have a lot more pressing problems right now?
I think we do, but I think in the same vein, the broadband aspect and technology helps address a lot of those issues. So when we talk about workforce development, having community job hubs and the technology in the community is serving a dual purpose. So I think it's a means to an end to be able to have broadband and connect residents to the latest technology and also train them in how to use the technology, because that will help us create more workforce-ready residents.
Last September, we spoke with Phil Spivak from the Baltimore Broadband Campaign. They're trying to get faster, cheaper internet into Baltimore using the fiber optic networks. And we asked how the city can help do that. Here's what he said.
The potential to fiber providers in Baltimore hasn't been entirely clear. And that's why one of the reasons we started our campaign. We think that where fiber providers go in, their businesses, they want to know that they're going to make money on their investment. And we think that that hasn't been demonstrated sufficiently in the city for them to be attracted.
What is the city doing to attract more companies to invest in technological infrastructure?
Well, it's an interesting question. Economic development was one of the aspects that we looked at as the task force, and we had private sector businesses, both large and small, on the task force. And it's market driven, and so in the areas where there's customers and business, we don't see a lack of broadband. I think in some aspects, there's certainly room for more service, which ultimately hopefully would lead to lower prices. And so part of this report and part of the plan is to be able to show Baltimore has a coordinated effort in broadband that we do have maps of our infrastructure and that we are interested in this issue. So I think just putting out the report and talking about our next steps has piqued the interest of the private sector in working with us.
Included in the task force report is an appendix from another report by Magellan Advisors, a consultant business, with a list of recommendations. And one of those is to leverage the city's fiber optic network to provide greater capacity and potential savings to Baltimore City Public Schools. Can you give me a sharper picture of what that means?
Well, I think the goal in schools was certainly part of the task force, was really to have all the city schools connected on city fiber. Right now, they're not, and that would be a goal. And once they're connected to city fiber, I think there's more long-term savings. But it also gives us greater capacity to serve the students. More learning is becoming digital and online videos, et cetera, in the schools. So that's one opportunity to ensure that we have the capacity for the future of learning and to be able to plan for that. The other opportunity is to use some of the city facilities, if they're connected to city fiber, for potential hub zones. So you could imagine having, wireless in the community or maybe even around the school building that people could come and connect to.
As you look at the range of options the task force has pulled together in this report, how much are we talking about public investment, the city's investment?
This is really the first step in establishing sort of the broad goals and the themes that we want to look towards in terms of making Baltimore a smarter city. But there's a lot more work that needs to be done in terms of scoping what the existing assets are, scoping what the needs are, and that is work to come.
That's Baltimore Deputy Mayor Colin Tarbert, co-chair of a task force that wants to know what the public thinks of its draft reports calling for expanded high-speed internet in the city. Public comments can be submitted for the next 3 weeks. We've got more information, including where to comment, on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast. This is Maryland Morning. Now let's pick up on that thread of our conversation with Colin Tarbert, investing in technology in schools. As executive director of the Digital Harbor Foundation, Andrew Coy has many ideas about how tech can transform our schools. Andrew Coy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Sheila. Nice to be back.
Now, how important would you say it is that we connect schools to a high-speed fiber optic network?
Absolutely essential, right? The opportunities that exist out there for young people to learn are online. And if we're not connected to that, what are we preparing youth for?
And fiber optics is the way to go.
It is absolutely essential that they're connected.
What could that do for learning?
Sure. So the transformations that are happening right now in the ed tech space are pretty transformational. What you see happening and what needs to happen, however, goes beyond just changing how students are learning to helping them become the creators of technology.
I'm not sure I get that.
So you can, if you talk about education technology and you're just focused on delivering the same content in an online format, so a textbook on an iPad, that is not transformational. That is just changing
that is efficient, perhaps, but not transformational.
And it's not necessarily even efficient, right? Textbooks cost less to make than an iPad. But what if you change it so that a young person is creating a piece of technology, they are becoming the producer, the maker of that. That is transformational. It empowers the young person. And in today's world, if you're not connected to the internet, you are not going to become a creator of technology. And all the jobs that are out there, require a higher degree of tech proficiency than ever before. So if we're not even connecting young people in our city schools to the internet at high speeds, we're not preparing them for the jobs that are already here, much less the ones that are going to be here in 5 or 10 years.
So what are the most important tech investments you think need to be made in schools?
Yeah, I think there's three main categories of tech investments that I would classify. One is the actual pipes that go into the systems, right? As the deputy mayor was speaking about, connecting schools to these high-speed internet pipelines is absolutely essential. Second is what the city is looking at with the community school movement to really help a physical space be used not just during a few hours of the day, but also after school by the community itself, and connecting opportunities for the for the community to come in and utilize these resources that sit dormant for a number of hours every afternoon and evening. And the third thing that I would say is essential to invest in are community spaces, these informal learning opportunities. So if you think about, you know, who even invented the internet, it was people who were tinkering and making and exploring in informal opportunities. They weren't, wasn't part of a classroom assignment. So how are we creating opportunities for today's young people to be the inventors and the creators, and where are they doing that? So what are we doing to invest in informal learning opportunities and spaces, whether it's an old rec center turned tech center like that?
That's what you did, right? That's what Digital Harbor did two and a half years ago.
Absolutely, yeah. I was a classroom teacher who saw the city close down a rec center that was two blocks away from my school and said, this rec center could become a tech center and provide all sorts of opportunities after school, summertime, and even now during the school day when schools come on field trips to our location.
So you have, I understand, more than 300 young people participating in programs this summer.
Yep.
What are they learning?
Yeah, so the more than 300 youth that are coming through our summer camps are learning everything from video and film production and editing using green screens and other tools to 3D printing. They're learning electronics, soldering, and programming. It's a whole variety of hands-on. But most importantly, what they're doing is creating and being forced to answer the question, what do you want to make? So often they're told what to do and how to do and when to do it. But very rarely do we ever sit back and ask a young person, what's in your mind? What do you want to do? What do you envision? And then give them an opportunity and a space to create that. But to do so, they need access to the internet. They need access to these resources. This wealth of human knowledge is that out there that without access to that, you know, they're limited by what's in the four walls of the room they're sitting in.
So what do you see happening next? I mean, you've talked about transformations in this conversation. What is the next step of transformation?
Yeah, we need to build up the capacity of the physical spaces, because if they don't have access to internet, that's a barrier. But we also need to build out the human capacity. You know, thinking about how do we support our educators, teachers that are in the classrooms, you know, what are they being asked to do and how often are they being asked to perform, have students perform on a test instead of asking them to help young people become creative, productive individuals. You know, and I stepped out of the formal school system because of my desire to create a different model. But I think educators all across the spectrum are interested and want this. We just need to support them and provide a different vision, a different path forward. And that involves infrastructure physical, that involves human resource infrastructure, where we're teaching and supporting teachers.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Andrew Coy, he's executive director of the Digital Harbor Foundation. 2.5 years ago, they turned an old rec center into a tech center. We have links to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We would love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins me with her review of The Comedy of Errors at the Chesapeake Shakespeare Company. But now it's time for Living Questions, our monthly series in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. Today, a conversation with two pastors who lead churches in Sandtown, Winchester, the Baltimore neighborhood which has become the focal point of attention since the riots in April in what has now become known as the Baltimore Uprising. At one time, there were more than 50 churches in Sandtown. There are now more than 30, which still represents a high concentration of churches in the 72-square-block area that Sandtown encompasses. So what can and should these churches be doing in this neighborhood, which has long struggled with high unemployment, poverty, addiction, and crime? We'll explore that question with two pastors who are doing a lot. Pastor Amelia Harris is the co-pastor of the Newborn Community of Faith Church. She has lived and worked in Sandtown with her husband, Elder C.W. Harris, for more than 30 years. Dr. Lewis Wilson is here in the studio as well. He came to Sandtown from Chicago in January, accepting the call to lead the New Song Community Church in Sandtown. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
So, Pastor Harris, you first went to Sandtown as a teenager, even before the riots that happened in 1968. You have a huge institutional memory of this neighborhood and this city. How has the work and the profile of the churches in that neighborhood changed pre-riots 1968, post-riots, and now here we find ourselves post-riot again in 2015?
When I think about, as a teenager, churches always represented not just the place of worship, but actually a place where families, we would all go together. So when the neighbors saw you walking to a particular church, it meant something. And after the riots in 68, in the beginning, it still kept everyone coming. But as years began to progress, you started seeing the family split. So you may see the mother, or you might just see the children going to Sunday school. And what I've noticed since that time is that we're really working hard at bringing that whole family back together, whether it just be a single mom and children or a single dad and children or whoever, but the whole family going, because I believe that they're feeling, they understand the importance of being in a place where they can find comfort and consolation.
And before the 1968 riots, what was Sandtown like as a community? Now, unfortunately, we do, you know, associate it with the blight and the abandoned homes and the poverty and the various problems that, you know, accompany all of those kinds of things. What was it like back in the 60s?
Back in the 60s, it was a thriving area. It encompassed all of the musicians, the singers. You hear them talk about Stevie Wonder, the Supremes. And I remember as a young girl growing up that they would come to the Royal Theater, which was on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Sure.
And that was the place that, as African Americans, we could come and be a part of the entertainment world. And so all of your local, all of your singers would just stop there and flood there. And it was at night. I remember my father driving down Pennsylvania Avenue, and it was lit up with lights, and it had stores, and he would take us in and buy all of the girls' dresses, and you could only get one kind of shoes, and that was Buster Brown's. And so it was thriving with people. Everybody knew each other, mm-hmm. and so you weren't a stranger.
Sure. You know, and if it was thriving then, perhaps it can be made to thrive again. Pastor Wilson, you came here from Chicago in January, so you've had a perspective of about 6 months. What are your impressions, both of the neighborhood now and its potential?
I think there's a lot of potential. I try to make a little bit of a habit of studying urbanization and the forces that are against it or forces that can even help it. I come from the south side of Chicago, a community much like Sandtown, Inglewood, where they do a lot of shooting and murders, and there's a lot of addiction and drug use and selling. I think there's a lot of hope for the community. I think one of the things, from my perspective, that we need to focus in on is men.
Men.
I think a lot of times we sort of ignore our men. We'll do things for our children sometimes. I was at a meeting the other day, and I understand why people want to do that. And so there's a push to employ our youth this summer, and I think that ought to be done. But there's a corollary factor that I think sometimes people don't consider. What about the man who's on the corner and now his son or his daughter has a job, but he doesn't? How does that make that man feel? What about the pain of this man? And we had a big affair Saturday, and you could see men standing on the periphery, you know, just looking in at something else that was going on with some of their, probably their kids, you know, or maybe their girlfriends or their wives even. And so, but I still think there's hope. I think it takes time. I think you have to build relationships with people. It's not just a program or a project. It's actually spending time and getting to know people one-on-one. And that's a very intensive kind of thing. My wife and I both, we spend time, you know, I'll just walk around the street sometime, you know, and just meeting people. And sometimes I'll wave at everybody, and sometimes nobody waves, but now they're starting to wave. Oh, that's, hey, Pastor, you know, he's like, well, I don't know who that guy is. So, but I'm starting to have a presence. And to me, it starts there. You know, you don't force yourself on people. You slowly take time to earn the right to speak into somebody's life. And I think if you believe that, I think we can see substantive change down the road.
You're listening to Living Questions here on Maryland Morning, our monthly series on religion in the public sphere. Today, we're talking about the ministries of two churches in Sandtown, Winchester, Newborn Community of Faith and the New Song Community Church with their pastors, Pastor Amelia Harris and Pastor Lewis Wilson. I'm Tom Hall. Pastor Harris, there is an organization that I guess was sort of dormant for a little while, which has recently been revived following the events in April, called Clergy United for Transformation of Sandtown. Talk about the work that that group is doing. I know you're involved with that. And what's the mission, and where does that stand, given what happened?
Well, CUTS was originally started under the leadership of Father Damien Nepal. He was the rector for St. Gregory the Great over on Baker Street and Gilmore. And he really worked in trying to bring all of the pastors, whether they had the large facilities or some with the storefronts. It was his aim and mission to bring the pastors together that they might be able to talk around the justice issues, talk around how we could help one another. And what happened was when Father Damien passed away, it really hurt the community because it was like a beacon of light there at St. Gregory. And so what those of us who knew and were a part of it, especially Elder Harris, said, we need to come back and let's do the things that we have been working so hard to bring about a unity of the churches, regardless of whatever background that you are. Show people that we as one nation, one community under God can work together, because there's a saying that we can't, you know, we stick with our own kind. And so we've come back even stronger because we've actually been knocking at doors saying, come, you know, you might be a new pastor on the block, but we want to embrace you and say we're here to help in whatever capacity that we can help you. Because a lot of time, if you're just starting from ground zero and you're new, most of the community, they've picked their churches, and so that's where they attend. And we want them to know you're welcome.
Mm-hmm. And Pastor Wilson, both you and Pastor Harris have a very holistic approach to addressing the problems in your community. Your umbrella organization is called the New Song Urban Ministries. Pastor Harris has the Newborn Holistic Ministries. I mean, the name states quite frankly and purposefully that you're looking at all of the needs, the spiritual needs as well as the material and physical needs of your congregants. Mm-hmm. You know, for years, I mean, ever since President George H.W. Bush and his Thousand Points of Light, particularly people on the political right, have advocated for churches and nonprofits to take over the role that some government social services agencies currently have. I wonder if there's just too much pressure on churches. I mean, you've got a building to run, you've got lights to keep on, you know, you've got ice to shovel off the sidewalks on Sunday. You've got a lot of things to take care of on a day-to-day basis. Do you feel a lot of pressure on institutions like yours, churches in particular, to pick up the slack where government or other agencies have let the ball drop?
I would probably say, first of all, that the Bible says he'll put no more on us than what we can bear. And so therefore, if there are issues and concerns that our community needs to confront, I actually believe the community itself has the wherewithal to do that. And let me explain that. I really go right back to Genesis, where it says that God says he blessed them and says subdue, rule, fill, multiply, and increase the earth. And I believe that every man, woman, and child has a capacity to be productive and has a desire to be productive. So it's not so much to me identifying all felt needs, it's peeling back the layers that stop that person from being all that God has designed them to be. There are people right there in Sandtown who have the wherewithal to change Sandtown. And I think we have to start there. That doesn't mean that we won't solicit help from government agencies or state agencies or nonprofits, but it means that we go with the idea that we're coming to help a people be what God has already equipped them to be, as opposed to us coming to them to make them to be something. They're already there, you know, so love them and all their gifts and all their talents and all their skills and all their values. And I think you'll see a substantive change.
Pastor Harris, the events in Ferguson and Staten Island and Cleveland clearly had an impact on our community's reaction to the death of Freddie Gray while he was in police custody. What do you think the impact of the tragedy in Charleston will be on Baltimore?
I feel as though the impact that has taken place just by the family members being in that courtroom, looking at the individual who committed the crime and the killings, to be able to say that we forgive you, may God have mercy. I think for the church world, those of us that understand that type of forgiveness, I feel like it intensifies my teachings that, yes, that is the way we've been taught. We hurt, yes. We will miss any loved one that goes away from us. We miss them. But for those of us that have been brought up under those teachings, then it just solidifies. I keep thinking that the scripture says, vengeance is mine, says the Lord, I'll repay. So, you know, you have these two groups and you're hoping that we can keep from repeating what we've just experienced.
Pastor Amelia Harris is the co-pastor of the Newborn Community of Faith Church. Pastor Lewis Wilson is the pastor of the New Song Community Church. Thank you both for your time this morning and for the work that you're doing in Sandtown. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
If you're interested in learning more about the social ministries of churches in Sandtown, Winchester, programs like Martha's Place, Strength to Love, Jubilee Arts, the New Song Community Learning Center, and the Winchester Street Potter's House, come to our website, wypr.org/livingquestions. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. You've been listening to the latest installment in our series, Living Questions, produced by WYPR in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies, where we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. You can hear this and other conversations in our Living Questions series when you visit our website. Again, the address is wypr.org/livingquestions. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Is there an issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
The Chesapeake Shakespeare Company has concluded its first season in their new home on Redwood Street in Baltimore. But for their production of The Comedy of Errors this summer, they've returned to their outdoor venue in Howard County. Maryland Morning theater critic Jay Wynn Russick has headed under the stars to see it, and she brings us this review.
The comedy in Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors stems from two pairs of identical twin servants and their identical twin masters. The servants can't tell the masters apart, the masters can't tell the servants apart, and neither can anyone else. This is where Scott Allen Small, director of Chesapeake Shakespeare Company's production, inserts some fun of his own, a sight gag. In the roles of the twin servants, he has cast a slender woman, Kelsey Painter, in drag, and a rotund man, Bobby Henneberg. Talented Kelsey Painter dashes frantically around Chesapeake's outdoor performance space, the ruins of the Patapsco Female Institute in Ellicott City. She even turns cartwheels on stage. Bobby Henneberg lumbers about jovially. When he tries to do cartwheels, he just sort of rolls around. But the first time Henneberg's character relates being mistaken for his twin, he's far from jovial.
"'Tis dinner time,' quoth I, my gold,' quoth he. "'Will you come home?' quoth I, my gold,' quoth he. "'Your meat doth burn,' quoth I, my gold,' quoth he."
Watching the other characters repeatedly mix up this dissimilar twosome is the best new joke in director Small's uneven production, a production that tries too much, too hard, and often at the expense of genuine feeling. Because make no mistake, the comedy of errors may be an early Shakespearean comedy, but there's a well of emotion underlying it. A husband and one of his twin infant sons have been separated from his wife and other twin in a shipwreck. The husband has raised the one twin in Syracuse, unaware that his wife and the other twin are alive and in Ephesus. To further complicate matters, the Syracusan master and servant have taken the names of their lost brothers, Antipholus and Dromio. Antipholus of Syracuse and his father are so desperate to find their lost family, they've risked their lives to come to Ephesus. The Duke of Ephesus, played by Kate Fortin, lays down the law at the top of the play.
"If any born at Ephesus be seen at any Syracusan marts and fairs, again, if any Syracusan born come to the Bay of Ephesus, he dies, his goods confiscate to the Duke's dispose, unless 1,000 marks be levied to quit the penalty and to ransom him. Thy substance, valued at the highest rate, cannot amount unto 100 marks. Therefore, by law, thou art condemned to die."
I'm not sure why the director cast a woman in the male role of the Duke. It's one of a raft of things, some comical, some inexplicable, tossed into a production lacking a unifying vision. For almost every clever new touch, there's another that doesn't work and detracts. The Kinks song, Lola, with the lyric, "Girls will be boys and boys will be girls," works because of the added cross-dressing. But why is the Battle Hymn of the Republic hummed in the opening scene with the Duke? Tall, gruff Jeff Miller is amusing as a grimy, hulking kitchen wench who falls in love with Dromio of Syracuse. But it makes no sense to see the same actor, cast against gender and decked out in a turquoise beehive wig, as the devout, broken-hearted mother of the Antipholus twins. The comedy of errors can withstand all sorts of embellishments. I've seen everyone from Charlie Chaplin to a pink llama show up on stage. But there's a difference between tweaking the humor and throwing everything at the script to see what will stick, from a Snickers commercial to a game of tug-of-war. Chesapeake Shakespeare's production has its moments, but not enough ends up sticking.
Well, I'm not dumb, but I can't understand why she won't like a woman but talk like a
Chesapeake Shakespeare Company's The Comedy of Errors is at the Patapsco Female Institute Historic Park in Ellicott City until July 19th. Information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us every Monday here on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Later in the program, a conversation with the poet Sue Ellen Thompson. Stay with us.
thoughts on that segment you just heard, email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Now we're going to revisit a conversation I had last year with the poet Sue Ellen Thompson, a mainstay at the Breadloaf Writers Conference for many years. Her work has been heard on the Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor and featured in the syndicated column of the U.S. Poet Laureate Ted Kooser. In her most recent collection of poems called They, Sue Ellen Thompson reflects on her relationship with her transgender child and the ways in which that child's identity animates and informs complex questions and steadfast love. Last December, way before Caitlyn Jenner was in the news, Sue Ellen Thompson crossed the bridge from her home in Oxford to talk about this powerful and provocative collection of poems. So let's talk about the title of the book, They. It's a pronoun that people familiar with the transgender community will recognize.
But no one else will. Actually, this has been one of the most difficult things for me as an English major, as a mother, to learn to refer to my child by a plural pronoun has been very difficult. And it was one of the most difficult decisions I faced in putting the manuscript together, because you will notice that many of the poems, certainly the ones that talk about her as a younger child, she did not come out as transgender until she was 26 years old. I still refer to her as she and my daughter. And this was a decision I made in partnership with my editor, who felt that the book was about a mother's journey. Mm-hmm. And that journey is still ongoing.
Let's have you read that poem. It's on page 68. It's interesting. It's in sort of the middle of this collection.
Yeah, it's actually closer to the two-thirds point.
Yeah.
I did not want to make this book chronological, a before and after. It's organized along emotional and thematic lines rather than chronology. They. Reading about the artist at my daughter's first solo exhibit, I notice that she refers to herself as queer, a once derogatory word that is now back in vogue. Unversed in the linguistic proprieties, I read on, hoping to unearth some clue as to the exact nature of her gender identity view of herself, and this is what I see. Their work is characterized by the play of the familiar and the unfamiliar, made from objects they have found within a five-block radius of their apartment. Who is they? Does she have a partner I've not met, a co-creator I know nothing about? Because my experience with coming out is limited to a gay friend from college, she sets me straight. Since neither he nor she is accurate, I should refer to her as they. Whether or not I'm okay with this is irrelevant. If I want to see her more than once a year, I may as well begin by unlearning the rule of noun-pronoun agreement. In this school, I am the student, she the teacher, they.
They is the title poem from Sue Ellen Thompson's new collection called They. She's here in our studio on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Did you consult with Thomason, your child, they, did you have a conversation about this book and about, because this is like your other book, The Golden Hours, you were in here a few years ago and we talked about that, in which you chronicled the death of your mother in mm-hmm. that one in large measure. Very personal. You mm-hmm. write very personally, and this one is certainly very personal. This one chronicles the death of your father, who mm-hmm. you know, survived your mom by several years. Did you and Thomason have a conversation about going so public with this very intimate subject?
Let's just say no is the first answer. And then when it did sort of come up after the manuscript was already together, it was not a good conversation. Thomason is someone who really does not enjoy being in the spotlight and never has. And of course, even though there is a very small reading public for poetry, it is kind of a spotlight. And if I had to get permission from the people I write about to write about them, I never would have become a poet.
Yeah.
It's not something I do.
So the same holds true for your mother, for your
mm-hmm.
father, for
my husband.
For your husband.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. I do what I have to do. This is what I do, and I be who I have to be.
For parents who are presented with this very complicated and, you know, deeply emotional issue by a child, mm-hmm. As you've thought about it, as you've written about it, as you've reflected on it, and perhaps even talked to other parents and other family members of transgender people, do you have any advice? Do you have any thoughts that you can share with them?
Well, my advice is usually get with the program, accept it, deal with it, and try to move on. There are so many worse things that one can have to deal with. But I have been through this with friends or friends of friends, acquaintances. I know how difficult it is. I mean, 8 years ago, I had never heard the word transgender or genderqueer. I did not even know what that meant. And I was not prepared for it. But once I was confronted with the reality, I just tried to move forward. I mean, you have no choice.
Sure, of course.
This is who they are.
Absolutely. Was it difficult for Thomason to come out to you? You write a poem about how you heard about it. What's your understanding of
apparently
their frame of mind?
It was difficult. I always thought she was gay, which, of course, is a totally separate issue, and was patiently waiting for her to come to me and announce that, because I thought that's what parents are supposed to do, wait for the child to come to them. And our relationship began to deteriorate to the point where I felt somebody had to say something because it was getting so difficult. And it was that provoked a long letter from her explaining what she was and the terminology and all of that. And that was 8 years ago.
This is a letter that you and your husband read at an anniversary dinner, mm-hmm. and you wrote a poem about it. It's on page 21 called Anniversary. I wonder if you could read that second part of it, the 2006 one instead of the 1979 one.
Okay. And this was the week I moved to the Eastern Shore. So I had no friends. I was brand new in Oxford, and it was November 15th is my wedding anniversary. November 15th, 2006. I meet my husband at a restaurant to celebrate. Instead, he hands me a letter in which our now grown daughter lays it all out, 4 pages, single-spaced, of things we've managed not to talk about. Each year in mid-November, I think of that restaurant, of the meal that was not eaten, the glasses that were not raised, of that letter whose secrets would require that we begin from birth again to know our only child.
Begin from birth again. Are you close, you and Thomason, now? There was obviously a period of estrangement, but...
Yeah. I mean, we communicate. We see each other. I will see them on Sunday. But close isn't the word that springs to mind. It's still a little difficult.
But it's a work in progress, perhaps.
It's a work in progress,
yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Sue Ellen Thomason, thank you for sharing the book and sharing your thoughts about it this morning.
Thank you, Tom.
Sue Ellen Thomason, her collection of poems is called They. It's published by Turning Point Press. Sue Ellen Thomason and I talked about it last December. We've got a link to more information on our website. Come to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. See you Wednesday. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Mary Wiltenberg,
Christy Forrest,
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day, 3 years ago, a storm known as a derecho struck 10 states, including Maryland. Wind gusts reached 80 miles an hour. 13 people were killed, and 4 million people lost electric power. We're back on Wednesday. Hope you'll join us.